Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Doug Tribou, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Bill Littlefield is off this week. The University of Miami illicit benefits scandal continues, but will the NCAA invoke the dreaded death penalty? That story's just ahead on Only a Game. Also, examining the career of slugger Jim Thome, the story of how malt and hops saved Seattle minor league baseball, and one intrepid radio reporter checks out yoga for bros or broga. Also ahead, the men's tennis duo calling itself the Indo-Pac Express rallies for peace beyond the tennis court.
All our lives, I've only seen Pakistanis and Indians on the other sides competing against each other. But with our partnership, I have seen that the Indians and Pakistanis sitting together, cheering for one cause and cheering for one team.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Doug Tribou, sitting in for the vacationing Bill Littlefield. It's tropical storm season, and this week South Floridians witnessed Hurricane Nevin tear through Miami and threaten to wipe out the University of Miami athletic program. Yahoo Sports broke the story early this week, and joining me now is Yahoo Sports national columnist Dan Wetzel. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks. Always good to be on.
The Nevin we're talking about is actually a former Miami booster who's now a convicted felon. Who is Nevin Shapiro, and what did he do that has the university in so much trouble?
Well, Nevin Shapiro, first and foremost, is a criminal. He ran a $930 million Ponzi scheme out of Miami Beach, Florida, and is serving 20 years in federal prison for that crime. Now, before that, when he was living a lavish lifestyle off of other people's money, he was a diehard Miami Hurricane fan and booster. He donated money to the school, and he also befriended and provided just an absolute unbelievable array of extra benefits. He broke virtually every NCAA rule we know except academic fraud. Other than that, he did it. So that is why they're in so much trouble. He's now telling his entire story to Yahoo Sports. He told it to federal investigators, and he's telling it to the National Collegiate Athletic Association right now.
Which of the infractions was the most egregious in your mind?
Well, some of the bigger ones were, you know, he also owned a sports agency, or part owner of a sports agency, so he would provide money for some players to sign with him there, and they did sign two first-round picks. It's really the totality of it. A lot of the benefits were maybe, you know, somewhat smaller, understandably, take guys out partying on his $1.6 million yacht. He'd have a VIP room at a trendy nightclub. There were dinners. Cash gifts, bounties on other players, wild parties involving ladies of the night, if you will, things like that. And it's really, as much as those are, they're sensational, the monetary totals weren't always overwhelming because of the number of players involved. It's just that for that long, he was just running almost unfettered through the Miami program. It wasn't one guy getting $500,000 or some guy getting a house or his parents getting a house that you sometimes hear. It was a ton of really entertainment through an eight-year period.
Why is this information coming to light now?
Well, Nevin, what he told us is he felt that during his time as a booster, and he's a guy who's only 42 now, he was in his 30s, he and the players had real relationships. And I do believe there were some pretty significant relationships. But he felt like we're family. We're brothers, we're going to help each other out. When you didn't have money or you got in a jam or somebody needed something, I took care of you. When he was arrested on the Ponzi scheme, he immediately goes to prison. Powerless place, it's an emotional place, and he was seeking help back. And he found most of the people, the coaches, administrators, and obviously players, he would call for help, either wouldn't call him back or wouldn't provide much. And so his reason for coming forward is both to cooperate with the federal government and revenge. It's fairly simple. He wants to hurt people that hurt him. He has absolutely nothing to lose, so he will tell pretty much any story that he can to hurt the Miami football program.
You and your colleagues have written extensively about the perks Shapiro provided to members of the University of Miami football team between 2002 and 2010. But players weren't the only people lining up to rub elbows with Shapiro, right?
No, and that's really the issue with college athletics. Everybody is on the take, and most notably the administrators. Everybody wanted Nevin Shapiro's money. University President Donna Shalala actively and personally sought donations from him, their athletic directors, their development people. The thing with college sports is everyone has their hand out. Everyone needs money. And so as much as a lot of the focus goes on to the players who took this or that, so didn't the adults, if you will. And that's really at the heart the issue with college athletics, because I think that's why the players don't believe in the rule book. It's why a guy like Nevin Shapiro never believed in anything the NCAA did and didn't care if he was breaking their rules. Everybody wanted Nevin Shapiro's money, and because of that, he felt extremely powerful in the situation.
The NCAA, of course, says it's investigating the matter, but does it really want to?
Well, I think I'm sure they wish this wasn't happening because there's really not a good side to this, but they do have an investigative unit, and they have some talented investigators, and those guys have been on it for 4 or 5 months. I know Nevin has told me what he's told them, provided them information. I mean, there's actually a great deal more information that we didn't publish because we were unable to corroborate it. But the NCAA may be able to because they have more powers to talk to players and administrators. So as big as this story is, it's not even the full story. I do think they're serious about this case because it's such a big deal. They need to tackle this full on, and they need to make some kind of statement with it. I mean, it's pretty rare we're talking college football scandals on NPR, and it's been on the nightly news. It's gone beyond sports. This case is so big.
The NCAA has the power to ban schools from competition, but that's only happened once in college football, when SMU football went away for the 1987 and 88 seasons. Do you think Miami will get the so-called death penalty?
I do not. It is on the table. I think they could do it, but I do not think they will. I think 1987 and 88 were a different era. Today's college sports are about television contracts, conference memberships, media contracts to shut down a program of the significance of the University of Miami. This is one of the storied powerhouse programs in a big TV market, would cost the NCAA a great deal of money. And I just don't believe the organization has the stomach for that. Should they is one debate, but the practicality is it's not a court of law. And so I do think there'll be penalties, but I do not think the death penalty will be enacted.
Dan Wetzel is a national columnist for Yahoo Sports and a regular guest here on Only a Game. Dan, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
The U.S. Open Tennis Championships get underway a week from Monday. As Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports, this year's Open marks the return of a doubles team whose performance last year put them on the world map.
While teammates Rohan Bopanna and Assam Elhook Qureshi practiced on Court 10 earlier this week at the Western and Southern Open in Mason, Ohio, just a handful of fans were watching alongside. But over the past 2 years, it's become clear that Bopanna from India and Qureshi from neighboring Pakistan are playing to a much larger audience. They call themselves the Indo-Pak Express. Qureshi says they've been using their prodigious skills on the tennis court to promote peace between two nations that over the last 60 years have held more wars with each other than U.S. Open titles.
All our lives, I've only seen Pakistanis and Indians on the other sides competing against each other and cheering for their respective teams. But for the first time with our partnership, I have seen that the Indians and Pakistanis sitting together, cheering for one cause and cheering for one team, which is for me is a beautiful sight. Just shows that sports is beyond all the religions, cultures, or politics. And it can reach boundaries. I think no politician can reach or no politics can reach.
Bopanna and Qureshi, a Hindu and a Muslim respectively, often sport warm-up outfits emblazoned with the slogan, "Stop War, Start Tennis." And they've been lobbying the leaders of their respective governments to let them play a tennis match straddling the often tense India-Pakistan border. The two met 15 years ago while playing junior tennis. After pursuing undistinguished singles careers and occasionally teaming in doubles competitions, they joined forces for keeps in late 2009. Since then, they've won twice on the ATP World Tour and made it to the finals of half a dozen other tournaments. Along the way, they've steadily moved up the doubles ladder, lately fluctuating between fifth and sixth in the world rankings. They've done so, Qureshi adds, by playing to each other's strengths.
We're still learning a lot about the doubles because we're very new. Thing is, I think we definitely complement each other's games. I lack a lot of power, to be honest, from the back of the court. Rohan has a big forehand, a big backhand, and a very, very huge serve. So I'm someone who just keeps hitting punches, small ones, but Rohan is the one who actually keeps hitting the knockout punches, you know?
When Bopanna and Qureshi reached the U.S. Open Finals last September against top seeds Mike and Bob Bryan, more than the media packed Arthur Ashe Stadium. Large numbers of Indian and Pakistani fans cheered side by side. So did the Indian and Pakistani U.N. ambassadors, who are more accustomed to squaring off on the U.N. floor. Karen Krause covers tennis for the New York Times.
Their match with the Bryans last summer was great, and I remember Bob and Mike saying it might have been the only time they ever played in a U.S. Open final where they were not the favorites. They felt like the crowd was really much more on the side of the other team, either with the fans from India or from Pakistan. Or here the Bryans should have had the home court advantage, and they felt like they were the underdogs.
While the Bryans went on to claim their third Open title on tiebreakers, 7-6, 7-6, they insisted afterwards that their opponents' initiatives off the court were more important than winning any Grand Slam tournament. In November, the duo from India and Pakistan received the ATP's 2010 Arthur Ashe Humanitarian of the Year Award. After practicing last Monday, Qureshi exchanged pleasantries and posed for pictures courtside with a Pakistani family. Also watching was Rahu Saligram, who lives in Schaumburg, Illinois, and hails from Bopanna's Indian hometown, Bangalore. Saligram and his wife follow the Indo-Pak Express in person and on Twitter, and he says that this unique tennis partnership is an idea whose time has come.
There are factions still, I'm sure, in India and Pakistan that say, how the hell can you play with that guy? But all the papers are saying the right things, the media, the TV, our friends, the people we know, they're all very excited. I have a coworker who's a Pakistani, and he cannot hold his, you know, smiles back when the last year when I went back and I told him about these two guys, and he started following them.
Bopanna admits that his play with Qureshi is still progressing and can't predict how far they'll go in this year's U.S. Open. He does, however, have a pretty clear picture of the singles match the two want to play at the Wagah border crossing, which is sometimes described as the Berlin Wall between India and Pakistan.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the only border where India and Pakistan you have to cross by foot. So, you know, that's the idea of Assam to play on the Indian side and me to play on the Pakistani side with the net in the middle of the border, of the gates.
Did you mention this to the ambassadors when you met them in New York?
Yes, yes. I mean, they very much knew about it and they were very supportive for it as well.
That would be a match in which Bopanna and Qureshi would see themselves as the home team. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. This year's Breck Epic Mountain Bike Race in Breckenridge, Colorado, attracted more than 200 elite riders hailing from 15 countries. The plan was to cover 240 miles over six stages. That was before somebody started messing with the arrows. Tuesday, markers set up to guide riders were moved and turned. According to the Summit Daily News, the mischief was corrected quickly, but several racers spent 15 to 20 minutes navigating trails that weren't part of the course. With no good solutions available, organizers decided to let the time stand without adjustments. Race leader Lico Ramirez was one of those fooled, but there was good news for the Costa Rican cyclist. He'd been so far ahead, he was still in first place at the end of the day, even after being taken for a ride.
There's a muddy road ahead, detour. Paid no mind what it said, detour.
I'm Doug Trabu. Bill Littlefield is away this week on his annual WPS Stadium Tour. Ahead on Only a Game, the tale of the Seattle minor league franchise whose fans were fond of the team's pitchers and mugs on the field and at the concession stand. But first...
Deep to left field. This ball's high. It's deep. Number 600 for Jim Thome.
Everybody out. On Monday in Detroit, Minnesota Twins designated hitter Jim Thome became just the eighth major leaguer to notch 600 home runs, joining Babe Ruth, Willie Mays, Henry Aaron, Ken Griffey Jr., Sammy Sosa, Barry Bonds, and Alex Rodriguez. Now the big slugger might get shipped out of Minnesota before the August 31st trade waiver deadline. Here to discuss that possibility, as well as Thome's recent accomplishment, is Lavelle E. Neal III, who covers the Twins for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Lavelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
Just a day after Thome hit his 600th and joined a very elite group of players, he was answering questions about whether he'd welcome a trade to a contender. Why would Thome want to leave Minnesota?
Well, you know what? I think Jim Thome loves Minnesota. He's embraced the culture here. He loves the fans. He's an outdoorsy guy, and definitely there's things to do outdoors in Minnesota in the summertime or wintertime if you brave the cold here. But the one thing that's eaten at him is that he has not won a World Series. He's been on two World Series teams, and both have lost in that series. Now, I think he would not be happy with himself unless he exhausted every possibility to win a title. So I think that's the one thing that would lead him to consider moving to another club if the Twins presented him with something like that.
Are the Twins actively shopping him? And if they are, what are the chances that a deal will happen?
Last time I checked with the Twins, they have not been shopping him. Of course, when you start making trades in August, a player has to clear waivers first, and the indications I have received lately is that he had not even been placed on waivers yet. And that's when it gets tricky. I mean, it's hard to move a guy on waivers because other teams may jump in front to try to block a team from getting him, and a team that doesn't have a chance of winning may actually put in the claim for some reason. And it's hard to make waiver trades. But if there was a way for Thome to end up on the contender, I think he would consider it, especially when you consider that he played for Philadelphia and the Phillies are definitely in the playoff picture, and he broke in with the Indians, and the Indians are in the race in the AL Central. So I think he would at least consider it.
Some have described Thome as the nicest guy in the world. Have you seen evidence of that covering him?
Oh, every day. He always has a smile on his face. He's always polite. Nice, firm handshake. Never says a crossword. He was voted one year, I want to say it was like 2005 or 2006, as the greatest teammate in baseball. That's how much respect he has in the clubhouse, just because of the way he approaches the game. And, you know, and teammates are amazed at the things he does. I mean, he may not be in the starting line of a day, but he still shows up at the ballpark like at 1 o'clock just to get his back stretching exercises in, just to get his flexibility in, just to make sure he's in good shape where he can go and pinch hit in the ninth inning if needed and not worry about pulling something. So he puts a lot of work in the game, and I think that rubs off on people who are around him.
You mentioned that Thome seems to like it in Minneapolis. Is the feeling mutual among the fans?
Oh, yes. They have taken to Thome greatly. And the thing is, when he steps in the batter's box and he strikes that pose when he's pointing the bat out toward the center field wall, you know, it gets everybody excited because you know if he makes a solid connection with the baseball, it's going to fly a long way. I mean, this guy is still hitting 450, 460-foot home runs at age 40. It's almost unfathomable that he could still do this. And he's about to turn 41, actually. So, you know, and here's the thing, too. The Twins and Thome have always respected each other. Even when Thome was with Cleveland, Ron Gardenhire was like a base coach, like the third base coach when Tom Kelly was managing. And he spent years talking to Thome when Thome was, you know, playing some third base for the Indians and then later on when he moved to first base. And I think they've always liked each other. So when Thome became a free agent a couple years ago, the Twins definitely made a move to sign him.
In a column that ran on Thursday, Star Tribune columnist Jim Suhan wrote that Thome, quote, joins Hank Aaron, Babe Ruth, Willie Mays, and Ken Griffey Jr. as one of the five to reach 600 without hearing so much as a rumor about cheating. With all due respect to your colleague and to Jim Thome, was Suhan listening closely enough?
I think so, but I think with Jim Thome, though, I don't think there's really been any major concern about whether he had done something illegal, because ever since he's been in baseball, he's been like this thick, burly guy, and no one's ever really wondered if Thome has key to hit some of these home runs. And, you know, he's had to pass the drug test when the league is administering him, so he hasn't failed the test. With other players, I mean, with Bonds, McGuire, Sosa, Palmeiro, others, you know, there's some damning evidence that they may have done some of those things, not with Tomy. And I think that's another reason why fans like him and follow him.
Tomy's 600th home run got a lot of attention, but it paled in comparison to the coverage of Derek Jeter's 3,000th hit earlier this season for the Yankees. Is that a product of spending most of his career in Midwest markets or playing during the steroids era or maybe both?
I think so. And, you know, they had HBO following Jeter around, you know, for a special about his path to 3,000. You didn't hear anything about Jim Tomy. And the playing putters, you know, there's been, you know, a couple dozen players or so who have had 3,000 hits, and there's only eight who have hit 600 homers. It's rare. It's a rare feat. But yet you didn't see national reporters following Tomy around as he got close or not. I it would have been interesting to see what would happen if Tomy had hit 599, and then there was a couple of days before he hit 600 to see if national media would have jumped on it and started following him a little bit closer if national television broadcasts were starting to break into Twins games whenever he batted. But Tomy didn't wait. As soon as he hit 599, he didn't hit 600. So we'll never know.
The Twins are well below 500 and won't make the postseason. Is there anyone suggesting Minnesota should keep Tomy for the remainder of the year so Twins fans have something to root for?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think fans would like to see Tomy finish out. And actually, now there's talk of, you know, can Tomy play one more year? I think even Tomy has brought that up. This has been a tough year for him. And, you know, the body's starting to bark on him. There's not too many 41-year-old baseball players around here. So the physical demands may be a little too much for him. But he's going to sit there and weigh out those factors. But if he does come back for another year, I think the fans would clamor to have Jim Tomy back in the Twins uniform.
Lavelle E. Neal III covers the Twins for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Thanks a lot, Lavelle.
My pleasure.
In the winter of 1941, Seattle's minor league baseball team was looking for a manager. The applicants included Rogers Hornsby, Grover Cleveland Alexander, and Babe Ruth. Five of the 13 men who attempted to land the job would eventually wind up in the Baseball Hall of Fame. In his new book, Pitchers of Beer, The Story of the Seattle Rainiers, Dan Raley chronicles the rise and fall of a team that attracted more fans than some of its big league counterparts. Dan Raley joins me now from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Welcome to Only a Game.
Glad to be here, Doug. Thanks for having me.
In the book's preface, you explain why a minor league team that's been defunct for nearly 50 years means so much to you, and I'd like to ask you to tell us how you grew so attached to the Rainiers.
I'd be glad to. When I was 9 years old, I lived in a city called Port Angeles, which was about 2.5 hours out of Seattle, and my father was the commissioner of the Olympic National Park, which was like a federal judge. And he took me to see the Rainiers. They came up there to play an exhibition game, and he took the whole family. And then, sadly, the following day in 1963, he was killed in a fairly spectacular car accident. So my last memories of my father were at a ballpark watching the Seattle Rainiers play. And my mother took myself and my brother and sister, moved us back to Seattle where she was from. And one of the things I did to divert my attention away from a tragic family shakeup was I would go to Sick Stadium and watch the Rainiers play, and I loved every minute of it.
Emil Sick bought the franchise in 1937. Sick was a brewer and a sharp businessman. He paid a San Francisco brewery $1.5 million for the naming rights to Rainier Beer, then immediately changed the team name to match. Why was Sick so well-suited to running a baseball team?
Well, this was the post-Depression era, and a lot of people were in recovery, kind of like the current day. And he was one of the few people that had money. In those down times, people still had to have alcohol, and he made it available. At one time, he was the leading brewer in the world. He had breweries all over Canada, and he was based out of Seattle, and so he had money to spend, and he decided to spend it on baseball.
The Rainiers' first manager, Jack Lelavelt, died in 1941. Babe Ruth was mentioned as a possible successor, but the Home Run King sent word that he wasn't interested.
Ruth soon changed his mind and lobbied hard for the job. Why didn't Sick go with the sport's biggest name?
Well, Babe Ruth turned him down. Babe Ruth was sick. You know, he'd been discarded from, you know, a coaching job in the majors and unable to get a managing job because of his free-spirited reputation. And he was sick, and he said no thanks through his wife from New York. And then he thought about it, and he thought, you know, these people actually came to me and offered me this job, and he got all excited about it. And Sick had moved ahead, you know, after the rejection. He needed a manager. Spring training was just around the corner, so Emil Sick went out and hired Bill Skiff, who was another former Yankee. I'm not sure Babe Ruth even remembered this guy because he played six games and had 11 at-bats. And so they made the hire, and then Babe Ruth calls up Emil Sick and says, I'm ready for that job. Emil, what do you say? And Emil says, I've given it away. So it was probably one of the greatest near misses in Seattle sporting history, bringing Babe Ruth to Seattle. He would have been, you know, wholeheartedly welcomed. It would have been fun. The teams didn't do very well when he wasn't hired, and so there was nothing to lose if they had hired him. And he might have died in Seattle and just changed the whole history of Babe Ruth and the Seattle itself.
You describe Rogers Hornsby as, quote, one of baseball's earliest Hall of Fame inductees, elite hitters, and overbearing egos. Emil Sick passed on hiring Hornsby in 1941, but did make him manager a decade later. Did Hornsby's method of removing pitchers pretty much sum up his treatment of his players?
Yes. For those curious to that one, Rogers would never leave the dugout. Unlike any other baseball manager, he would just point to the bullpen and wave a guy in. He was such a perfectionist or hard-edged guy that he didn't want to go out and talk to a pitcher on the mound that was struggling. So he had his own unique style.
I love that he restricted his pitchers from throwing sliders, referring to them as nickly curves.
Marv Grissom, who was a major league pitcher and made a living off that pitch, ignored him, and Rogers would argue with him about it, but Grissom won 20 games for him, so there's a little bit of mediation on it at that point.
Pitchers of Beer is loaded with behind-the-scenes baseball stories peppered with familiar names, and they're far too many for us to cover here, so I'd like to ask you to share one of your favorite Rainier stories.
Well, the one I like the best is kind of blue, and it involves a man who is now a bank president in Seattle at Seattle Bank. His name is Pat Patrick. And back in 1956, he was a bat boy for the Seattle Rainiers, and he'd won a contest in the paper I used to work for in Seattle, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and he was named a bat boy. And part of that job, he was given keys to everything in the stadium, and he was very curious about the stadium, and he liked to wander around and look at different nooks and crannies. And he noticed a stairway in a darkened hallway, and it was right near the first base dugout and right over the visitor's clubhouse, and He wondered what was in there, and so one day he took a set of keys and walked up there and unlocked the door and went in, and it was like a little apartment, and it had a couch, fold-out couch, and a little table and a bathroom, and it was a little studio apartment right in the middle of the stadium. And while he was up there, he heard steps coming up the stairway, and so he ducked behind the only thing that would hide him, and that was the couch, and in walked a Rainiers player that he knew, and accompanied by a woman that he didn't know, and this Pat Patrick, hiding behind the couch, had to keep quiet as personal relations took place. And his quote in the book, which is my favorite, was, I was never more afraid and excited in my life. And he swore that he'd never tell the identity of the player. But he mentioned this, and the general manager found out, was outraged that this type of thing was going on. And what was happening was the team trainer was basically renting out the room to those players and making a little money on the side. And that man was fired on Monday.
And the apartment was really there for scouts and other visitors who were in town on more serious business.
Exactly. And they later filled it full of equipment, trying to discourage anybody from using it for anything other than baseball activity.
I'm speaking with Dan Raley, the author of Pitchers of Beer, and you're listening to Only a Game. In the early years of the franchise, Seattle wasn't the major city we think of today. You often mention the Rainiers' widespread popularity. At one point writing, practically overnight, Rainiers baseball had woken up a depressed, slumbering town. How did a Pacific Coast League baseball team manage that?
Well, you know, Seattle's like the most far-flung city on the American continent, and, you know, just way out of reach from everything, from New York, from the East Coast, from Major League Baseball at that time. And the Pacific Coast League was a nice alternative, but it took over Seattle. You know, they had sports like University of Washington football and a couple other things, but nothing really to grab onto like this baseball team, you know, turned the city upside down and started packing the ballpark, started winning championships, and had some, you know, people that became heroes like Fred Hutchinson, who now is the International Cancer Center named after him in downtown Seattle that people come to. And so it just became, you know, a part of the fabric of Seattle, and it helped it become eventually a big league city.
As Seattle grew and changed, baseball did the same. The Dodgers and Giants relocated from New York to California in 1958. The minor leagues were becoming less independent and ceding more control to major league organizations. What was the ultimate undoing of the Rainiers?
I would say the invasion of the major leagues, which was inevitable. I mean, you had all these people moving west, all these California cities that were starting to become major population centers, and we got, you know, airline travel, which Seattle was responsible for. We built the first jet airliners, and all of a sudden the country changed in the 50s. So Seattle kind of got left behind at that point. They were still, you know, a step below San Francisco and Los Angeles, who drew the major league franchises that moved from, you know, New York City and Brooklyn. And so Seattle had to wait its turn. But that was the end of the Pacific Coast League for the Northwest, because it wanted to become a big league city. It had the World's Fair, and it was determined to have big league sports. And one by one, it got each one of those.
Dan Raley is the author of Pitchers of Beer, The Story of the Seattle Rainiers, which is published by the University of Nebraska Press. And he joined me from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Dan, thanks a lot.
Hey, Doug, thanks for having me.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
There's a statue of a little boy surfing near Highway 101 in the Cardiff-by-the-Sea section of Encinitas, California. Apparently, the many surfing aficionados in this San Diego suburb think the boy's delicate pose atop his board is an insult to a demanding sport. They've dubbed him the Cardiff Coop. And since he was unveiled in 2007, pranksters have dressed him up as Michael Jackson, Oprah, Vincent Van Gogh, and others not particularly known for surfing. The Los Angeles Times reports local officials don't think it's funny. They've issued warnings and recently paid $2,000 to repair damages. But last weekend, a massive winged lizard from another age mysteriously appeared atop the statue, clutching the surfer boy's arms in his talons, apparently ready to whisk him away. If Southern California doesn't want the Cardiff Kook, he might be welcome in the land of the lost. I'm Doug Tribou, in for Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, I find out what happens when you combine bros and yoga. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for his weekly look at the news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Doug.
Nevin Shapiro claims he gave at least 72 University of Miami athletes cash and gifts and provided some with prostitutes between 2002 and 2010. In light of the Yahoo Sports expose about Shapiro, the NCAA says it may waive the four-year statute of limitation on violations during its investigation. How do you see this playing out?
First of all, are we distinguishing between gifts and prostitutes? Because, I don't know, there's a distinction. I admire your ability to make that measured choice. Yeah, I think this has been a whopping big embarrassment for the NCAA. the gentleman at the center of it is doing 20 years for a $930 million Ponzi scheme. I don't really think he cares whether or not Miami has a football program in 5 years.
Meanwhile, attorneys representing the victims of that Ponzi scheme are also interested in the Miami case. They'd like to recoup the value of Shapiro's gifts to players. How do you like their chances of recovering those two Cadillac Escalades Shapiro claims to have given to former Miami star and current New England Patriot Vince Wilfork?
I'm not a lawyer. I just play one on the only a game analysis section. But, I mean, I do think that they are within their rights to claw back everything they can possibly claw back from this crook. And that may, in fact, include somebody's Escalade.
The NFL has declared former Ohio State quarterback Terrell Pryor eligible for Monday's supplemental draft. Pryor left Ohio State when he found out the NCAA was going to suspend him for 5 games for his role in selling off Buckeyes memorabilia. Good thing he avoided that suspension, huh?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure why it's the NFL's business to enforce the NCAA's stupid rulebook. But apparently the NFL has decided to do that. I don't understand why this guy has to be suspended from one organization for breaking another organization's rules, unless you're just trying to prove that once you leave high school, you get in part of this gigantic monopolistic cooperative venture that starts when you're 18 and ends when your physical abilities run out.
This week in a radio interview on ESPN New York, Eli Manning declared that he considers himself to be in the same class as elite quarterbacks like Tom Brady. Think that other Manning feels snubbed?
No, I think everybody's aware that Eli's aware of how good his brother is. I'm just not sure Eli's aware of how good Eli is.
Major League Baseball is touting the fact that one of their own has become the first North American professional athlete to test positive for HGH. Gee, that's something to be proud of.
Woohoo! Trivia question. A minor leaguer, by the way, for the Colorado Rockies, named Mike Jacobs, has tested positive for HGH. Now we're going to have, you know, a wonderful whooping and shouting from the drug warriors and little respect for people's privacy, and we go on and on.
When criminal defendants enter a federal courthouse, Charlie, they pass through a security checkpoint. At least that's what Bill tells me. Metal detectors are a common security feature, but will the courts be installing baseball detectors after Roger Clemens' mistrial last month?
This is remarkable. It's also something that I remember very vividly. I happened to cover the should he go to the hospital, should he go to prison proceedings in Milwaukee for Jeffrey Dahmer, and there was a county jail guard there who got fired because he was selling Jeffrey Dahmer's autograph. At that point, I decided that memorabilia people will do almost anything you can think of, and that there is, as soon as you think there's a bottom to the barrel, you discover that the barrel may very well be bottomless. So the discovery that Roger Clemens' autograph is being sold by security guards at a federal courthouse surprises me not at all.
An exhibition basketball game in Beijing between Georgetown University and China's Beiyi Rockets wound up looking more like Crouching Hoya, Hidden Dragon after the teams got into an ugly brawl. But a few trinkets from the airport ought to clear everything up, right?
Yeah, they seem to have made nice at the airport on their way out of town. The interesting thing about it is the Chinese basketball fans are all over their own team, which happens to be owned by the Army, by the way. For its part of the brawl, Georgetown seems to have fans on both sides of the Pacific.
Meanwhile, the Chinese Basketball Association says it's happy to welcome NBA stars like Chris Paul, Carmelo Anthony, and Kobe Bryant, who are considering playing in China during the NBA lockout, but I guess they'd better plan on staying a while.
Yeah, it's interesting that David Stern has made common cause with his fellow authoritarians on the other side of the water to make sure that there's no outlet for people during the lockout. I'm very impressed by this.
It's really, really happening this time, Mr. NASCAR.
Yeah.
Danica Patrick will be making the full-time move to stock car racing in 2012. She's been splitting her time between NASCAR and IndyCar for a while now. Is it too cynical to say that she'll now only be underperforming in one league?
Well, I think it is a little bit too cynical. Let's see. Maybe she does better in a crowd. Maybe she's a better stock car racer than she is an IndyCar racer. Let's see.
NASCAR has announced that its Hall of Fame induction ceremony will be moved from May to January in an attempt to increase fan interest. Should we be worried that the NASCAR Hall of Fame is only in its third year and is already shifting gears?
No, apparently this goes back to this is real old school NASCAR. They used to have a fan-oriented season preview in mid to late January. It used to be sponsored by R.J. Reynolds. This was back when the tobacco companies were sponsoring NASCAR. This is apparently well thought of and a beloved memory for a lot of NASCAR fans, so this is to an extent a throwback to that.
Nate Smith, an 11-year-old from Minnesota, made a $50,000 hockey shot during a charity game last week, Charlie. The only problem was that Nate's twin brother, Nick, was the guy whose name was called to take it. Now the company that insured the promotion says it will take 3 weeks to process the claim and decide whether the claim will be paid. Are they just hoping we'll all stop paying attention?
I think so, because they will pay this claim otherwise. Insurance companies don't have the greatest public relations in the world right now. They don't need another black mark. I suspect the Smiths, one or the other, will get the money, and then they can go out in the backyard and fight over it.
The New York Islanders held a viewing party for fans last night. The original programming for that party was scrapped. Why is that?
Because it was a film of a game against the Penguins on February 11th that had 15 fighting majors and 346 minutes in penalties and resulted in two Islanders being suspended and the team being fined $100,000. You know, hockey's trying to sell itself as kind of a mainstream sport, and putting the Battle of Shiloh up there to raise money is probably not the way to do it.
And finally, Charlie, you've written about Boston Celtics point guard Rajon Rondo. Do you agree with Shaquille O'Neal as to why Rondo hasn't made a three-pointer since February 22nd?
Apparently, they were visiting the White House, and in his new book, Shaq says that President Obama dissed Rajon Rondo's jump shot, at which point Rajon Rondo fell apart and couldn't hit a jump shot anymore. I hope this doesn't get around Massachusetts prior to the next election, or the president might be in trouble.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America and several other books. He joins us on Only a Game each week at this time. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Doug.
It's not news that there are dudes, guys, buds, and fellas who practice the ancient exercise regimen of yoga. But the simple fact is that most men do not do yoga and aren't planning to anytime soon. Enter Broga, a yoga class designed for, well, bros. Broga's creator and instructor is Robert Sidoti. The 41-year-old is blonde with a trim, muscular build. He says he started practicing yoga about 10 years ago as a supplement to other workouts.
First of all, it's a great feeling, you know, and then when it was applied toward, you know, I played a lot of basketball, a lot of golf, you know, it affected my flexibility in a real positive way, and also the strength, you know, I was able to hit the golf ball longer, I was able to play longer, my stamina was increased, so I just really fell in love with it.
Sidoti lives on the island of Martha's Vineyard, where he runs a small landscaping business and his wife teaches yoga. The couple and their son spend 2 months of the year in California, where Sidoti grew up. He says the name Broga was born during a get-together with old friends.
One of my close friends who drinks Coca-Cola and he smokes his cigarettes, and he's like that guy. No judgment, that's just who he is. And I'm like, I'm so into yoga, man. This stuff's so cool. You know, I'm like really digging it. I'm talking it up. And he's like, man, you need to do something for the bros. What about Broga? And it was just like ding, 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 ding.
Sidoti started teaching Broga on Martha's Vineyard about 3 years ago. Earlier this summer, he started another class in Somerville, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. My wife and my mother-in-law enjoy yoga, but I've never tried it. So on a Saturday morning 2 weeks ago, I decided to man up and find out what Broga is all about.
Come on in, just getting started.
The studio on the lower level of a large community building is dimly lit, and there's a faint smell of incense. Mirrors line the wall along the front of the room, and before long, the space is pretty full, with 14 people on rectangular orange mats.
Slowly start to just observe the breath as it travels in and as it leaves your body. Make the connection.
After some quiet breathing and stretching, we move into poses, and it quickly starts to feel like a real workout.
Breathe in here and exhale, lower all the way down. Untuck your toes, lift off cobra pose. Exhale, downward dog.
It seems that there are several yoga beginners in the group. It takes one to know one. And Sidoti makes a point to stroll past our mats to offer some guidance.
And then you lift through the waist, alive up through the waist, ribcage. Send the left knee forward more, Doug. Keep the right heel lifted for this one. That's the warrior stance.
Winthrop, Massachusetts resident Adam O'Neill is Sidoti's friend and business partner and is working to market Broga. O'Neill took up yoga several years ago after suffering a back injury at the age of 25 while working as a carpenter. O'Neill admits he should have come around much sooner. His mother's been teaching yoga for 30 years in his hometown in upstate New York.
I was a collegiate athlete. I played a lot of sports in high school, and I was aware of the potential great benefits of it, but it was just like, I'm not doing that, dude. Like, I'm not going, you know? And even to my mom, she would kind of be like, you know, you really should do it, Ad. You know, you really need to go try it. But I thought, you know, no way. That's crazy. I'm not going to do yoga.
It's like the ultimate I told you so moment for your mom, right?
Yeah, totally.
O'Neill says some men are surprised to learn how challenging a yoga workout can be.
You can't muscle through it like you always could. You can't bang out a couple more reps on the, you know, bench press or just like dig deep and try to push a little harder on that mile run. Yoga is very much about living in that uncomfortable moment, and rather than trying to avoid it, learning to manage it and to deal with it and to find peace in that.
Yoga Journal is the top-selling magazine about yoga in the United States. In 2008, the publication commissioned a survey of more than 5,000 people. The study found there were approximately 15.8 million yoga practitioners in the U.S., and nearly 28% of them were men. John Capuya is a professor of nonfiction writing at the University of Tampa. His book, Real Men Do Yoga, was published in 2003.
Yeah, I don't believe that at all. I would just be very surprised if almost a third of the people in this country right now who practice yoga are men.
Capuya says he thinks fear of embarrassment keeps many men from giving yoga a shot.
I mean, I think it's kind of like the stereotype, well, men won't ask for directions when they're driving. You know, they don't want to go to a room in front of a bunch of women and then, like, the person says, okay, you know, shining upside down dog pose, and you don't know what she's talking about, and you don't do it, and, you know, you're behind. And I think some people are reluctant to put themselves in that position.
Lengthen your spine. So reach your head toward the mirror. Long legs, hands resting on the shins.
Halfway through the hour and 15-minute class, I know my hamstrings are going to be killing me by the next morning, if not sooner. Push-ups are part of my regular exercise routine, but holding the plank pose in between reps isn't. And my shoulders will be hurting, too. Much as I hate to interrupt the flow of my workout, I periodically leave my mat just to check on my recording equipment. You know, to be sure it's still working.
Good. All together. Exhale.
Most of the poses we're doing today are common in regular yoga classes. Sidoti says he emphasizes upper body exercises to appeal to men with something they're likely to do well already. By design, there's no chanting or ohms, and few of the spiritual aspects found in some classes. He also incorporates a strong cardio component into each class, and that's where Hindu squats come in. The move involves squatting, sweeping your arms so your fingers graze the floor, then rising as you pull your arms back and thrust your chest out. As we repeat them in rapid succession, the breathing gets heavier, the room gets hot, and the mirrors behind Sidoti become completely fogged.
Breathe in and out.
This is Somerville resident Paul Lowenstein's second time at Broga. He says he's been to a few regular yoga classes, and he notices the difference.
This yoga, I definitely sweat more than any other yoga I've done before. I kind of hate it at the time, but it's good in the end.
Broga's aimed at men, but the classes are open to anyone, and half of today's group is women. Carolyn Burke and Laura Mandelberg both live in Somerville. Mandelberg says she enjoyed the upper body workout. Burke says she's taken traditional yoga classes, but never felt flexible enough to fit in.
I've done a few, but it actually kind of scared me away from yoga because it's always put your leg behind your head and twist like a pretzel. And this one, I didn't feel like I had to contort my body into weird poses that I cannot do because I'm not flexible at all. So in that sense, it was actually more appealing to me, I guess because it was centered for guys who can't really do that either.
But it wasn't just the workout that lured the women to a class designed for guys.
I was brought out with the promise that there would be hot, sweaty men. Which sounds a little shallow, but I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. How about you?
Well, I promised her hot, sweaty men.
Broga is not a moneymaker yet, and adding a class on the mainland is a huge commitment for Sidoti. Every Saturday, he takes a 6 a.m. ferry from Martha's Vineyard, which takes him to a bus, which takes him to a subway, and after a 20-minute walk, he arrives at the studio for a 10 o'clock class. If they develop a regular following at the new location, Sidoti and O'Neill say the next step for Broga is finding and training instructors in other cities. Eventually, they'd like to offer a full range of instruction videos online. Sidoti says the name Broga gets people's attention, but it's a blessing and a curse.
My battle with Broga is I'm offering something and creating something, a concept that I believe is real, it has depth, there's integrity, but I have to understand that it's a name that you can really play with. You know, I mean, there are so many broisms that you can throw in with this. You know, it's like, get with the program, stop procrastinating, get to the, you know what I mean? It's like, it's marketable beyond.
And that concludes the story of my first experience with yoga. It was great exercise, and I'm planning to give it another shot. I even picked up some of the lingo. Namaste, bro. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given. Our technical director is John Parati. We had help this week from Gwendolyn Clayton at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view my Broga picks or learn more about this week's music selections like this groovy one, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Broga instructor Robert Sidoti, who assesses my Broga skills.
Well, my observation of you was that you adapted pretty well to it, pretty quickly.
Far out. I'm Doug Trabu. Bill Littlefield returns next week. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.